So imagine for a moment, if you will, that you were one of the first followers of Jesus. Just try to put yourselves in one of their shoes for a minute. A week ago, you traveled with Jesus to Jerusalem for the Passover festival. And when you got there, something amazing happened. It was like the culmination of everything you had been hoping for. The people in the crowds treated Jesus like this celebrity, like a rock star. Like they thought he was the king, and they said he was the king, and they worshiped him, and they adored him. And it was like everything you had been hoping would happen was starting to happen. And then, 2 days ago, you saw the religious leaders finally have it out with Jesus. And you saw one of your best friends betray Jesus. And you saw the authorities arrest Jesus. And then they tried Jesus. And then they beat Jesus. And then you watched them crucify Jesus. And it was almost like, as you watched this unfold, you saw him on the cross, and you could hear him pray for the forgiveness of the people that were crucifying him. And it's like you realize something huge was happening, that the person that God had sent, this Messiah, this person you had been following, was somehow dying for the sins of the world on the cross. And then, this morning, you got word that Jesus was alive, that people had seen him, that he had risen from the grave, and that something miraculous had happened. And it's almost like all the sin and the suffering and the bad stuff and the junk and all the stuff you saw last week, it's almost like God had taken all of that and he had flipped it on its head. And somehow in Jesus' resurrection, something new had happened, and there was new life, and there was new hope, and there was new faith, and it was something you could celebrate. And you could almost imagine, again, putting ourselves in the position of these first followers of Jesus, that they must have celebrated. They must have been overwhelmed with joy because something amazing had happened in the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And now they had new faith, and now they had a new mission in life. And yet, the Bible tells us that's not actually how the disciples felt at all. In fact, they were really confused. They had no clue what had happened. They couldn't put it all together. They were confused as to why Jesus would be crucified. They were confused about this news that they had heard. Many of them didn't even believe the news when they heard it. In fact, some of them even saw Jesus and they still didn't believe that it was him. They doubted. Some of them felt like failures because they had deserted Jesus just a couple of days before and they didn't know what to do. Some of them were afraid, the Bible tells us. Like this guy, they meet him, the risen Jesus, and he's just died, and then he's just risen from the grave. Like he's pulled off the most miraculous thing that any human could ever see. And the disciples were scared to tell anyone about it. They were scared of what was going to happen to them if anyone found out about it, if it was even true. And again, many of them didn't even believe it was true. In fact, what's fascinating about the whole thing is that more than the confusion, more than the fear, more than the doubt, more than the sense of failure, more than anything else, in the few hours and days and weeks that followed after Jesus rose from the grave, the disciples, more than anything else, were just plain clueless. They had no idea what to do with this new news. They had no way, no idea how to process it. And in fact, you know what they did? They just went back home. And it says that a bunch of them went back to fishing. They went back to doing the very thing that they were doing before they even met Jesus, almost as if they had never met him and the resurrection had never even happened. Now, this is a little bit comforting to me because when I read about these first followers of Jesus and I read about that, I can see myself in that. Because I got to admit, sometimes I'm pretty confused when I read the Bible, when I think about who Jesus was and try to figure out what that means. Sometimes I'm scared because I'm not sure what to do with some of that information. Sometimes I sort of feel like a failure in light of all the stuff that I should maybe believe or should know. Sometimes I have my doubts. Like, I'm not sure I buy all of it. And yet, when I read about these first followers of Jesus and I see them in the midst of all their doubts and their fears and their confusion and their failure, what's amazing is that in just a few days' time, in fact, in about 6 weeks' time, if we read their story, we see that this group of men and women who were so confused, so doubtful, didn't get it, didn't understand the whole Easter, the whole thing, in 6 weeks' time, they went to a group of men and women whose lives were radically transformed and who would eventually radically transform the entire world when they would launch what became the Christian movement. And so what we're going to do for the next 4 weeks here in our messages is we're going to look at what happened to this group of men and women. Like, what happened between the resurrection and when Jesus finally left them and they became a very different group of men and women. What happened as they interacted with Jesus? What did he say to them? What did they do where they came to this new point in life where they were able to start living life in light of this new reality of Easter? Living life from Easter. And what can we learn about living life from Easter? So, if you brought a Bible, turn to Luke chapter 24. If you didn't bring one, you can grab one out of the pew in front of you. And I forgot to look up the page number. Luke 24, who can get there the fastest? Luke is in the New Testament. 738. You were there first, weren't you? No. Okay, page 738, Luke is in the New Testament, and we're going to read one of these stories. So for the next 4 weeks, we're going to read different stories of interactions that people had with Jesus after the resurrection. And the one that we're going to read today is about two disciples in particular. And it's Easter Sunday, and they've been there for the whole weekend, and they saw Jesus crucified. And everything they had put their hope in had ended. And they're dejected and they're hopeless. And they've heard news that he rose from the grave, but they don't believe it. And they don't know what else to do, so they decide to just head home. And this is what it says in Luke chapter 24, starting in verse 13. Now that same day, which we know from earlier was Easter Sunday, that same day two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about everything that had happened. Now, let me stop there for a second. We don't know a whole lot about these two disciples. later, we found out that one of them is named Cleopas. And we know that Cleopas wasn't one of the original 12. So sometimes in the Bible, when it says the disciples, it means the 12, like the select 12. But many times when it says disciples, it just means the bigger group. There were more like 40 or 50 or maybe even 100 people that followed Jesus and were considered his followers and his disciples. So Cleopas was in sort of that bigger group. We don't know anything about the other person mentioned in this, but most scholars think it's probably Cleopas's wife. Like, this is probably a couple that's heading home to the little village of Emmaus after the weekend of being in Jerusalem. Now, another interesting thing is this is the only time in the entire Bible that the village of Emmaus is mentioned. It's only 7 miles from Jerusalem, so not very far, maybe 2, 3, 4 hours walk. And again, this is the only time it's mentioned. So it's a really small little town. And yet, Emmaus had huge historical significance. Because about 200 years before this happened, the nation of Israel wasn't really a nation. They were being dominated by the Syrians at that time. And the Syrian armies and the Syrian government dominated the nation of Israel. And so they were living under oppression. And they wanted to get up out of that oppression. And the temple was maybe about to be defiled by these Syrian governors and maybe even be destroyed. And this deliverer rose up out of the Israelites. And his name was Judas Maccabeus. And there's actually a story about him that becomes the story of Hanukkah, which is what Jewish people celebrate in December every year. But you can go Wikipedia that and learn about that. But Judas Maccabeus, he raises up and he gathers the people together and he becomes this military hero. He gathers the armies together. And in the little village of Emmaus, Judas Maccabeus and his armies ambush the Syrian armies, and they surround them and they destroy them. And that's like the turning point in this revolt and in this rebellion. And ultimately, it would lead to the Israelites becoming an independent nation and throwing off their oppressors. And the Battle of Emmaus became like this turning point battle. It's like the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, or the storming of the beaches of Normandy. That's what people knew when they heard of the Battle of Emmaus. It represented God raising up a deliverer, a military hero, to save Israel and help them win independence from their oppressors. So anybody living in the little village of Emmaus, or probably anyone living in Israel at that time, knew about that and probably had their hopes pinned on God that he would raise up another deliverer to throw off the oppressors in that day, which was Rome. Rome was oppressing Israel. And so people waited for a Messiah, a deliverer, who would be this military hero. And you've got to think that this couple has this on their minds as they're walking home that day. The story goes on, and it says in verse 15, as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" You see, tons of people have been in Jerusalem for the Passover festival. This was like the biggest festival of the year, and all the pilgrims would travel to Jerusalem, and so many people had traveled there, and all the pilgrims on Sunday were probably traveling home. And yet this couple look at the strange man they meet on the road and they go, did you not hear what happened in Jerusalem this weekend? Have you not heard about these things? Goes on in verse 19, Jesus responds, "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all of this took place." So they say, "Don't you know? It's Jesus of Nazareth. He was crucified. He was this man who was great, and we had sort of pinned our hopes in him. We thought he was going to be the one that was going to redeem Israel. And yet, clearly, he wasn't. Because the military authorities took him, and they tried him, and they crucified him. And what's more, he's been dead for 3 days. Now, this is always a little confusing because sometimes, if you know your chronology, the crucifixion took place on Good Friday, and this is Sunday, and so in the way we count, it's like Friday to Sunday, that's 2 days, you know, like that's 48 hours. Like, where does this whole third day thing come in? But Jews always counted days inclusively. So in their mindset, and the way they count it, and this is not just true in the Bible, but in all kinds of ancient writings by any Jews, if Jesus died on Friday, that would have still been part of the first day. Saturday would have been the second day, and Sunday would have been the third day. So that's why they say it's been 3 days. And furthermore, it was a belief in Jewish sort of beliefs that whenever anyone died, the soul would stay with the body for about 3 days, and then the soul would eventually leave the body. And it's almost like they're saying, look, it's been 3 days. He's dead. He's gone. The movement is dead. The movement is gone. There is nothing left to hope in. They go on verse 22. They say, in addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but they didn't find his body. And they came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. In other words, to make matters worse, some of our women, some of the followers who were women, wanted to go to the tomb this morning because they were mourning, and they went, and they couldn't find the body there. And then they started hallucinating, like they were seeing things. They started seeing visions of angels, and they came back telling us these crazy stories. And so then Peter decided to go to the tomb and check things out, and when he got there, he couldn't find the body either, which means somebody stole the body. It's almost like adding insult to injury. Like this Messiah, this person that we worshiped, our best friend who's died, and now like the religious leaders, that wasn't enough. Like somebody had to go and steal the body. And they just don't know what to do with this. Now, it's important to understand what these two disciples are confused about and why they've decided to just head home. I think they're confused about three things. First, they're confused about who Jesus is. Because in their minds, they had a picture of what the Messiah was supposed to be like. In their minds, the Messiah was a military hero. He was going to lead the Israelites to victory and throw off the Romans. And as they began following Jesus, sometimes he did things that didn't really look like he was the Messiah, but a lot of times he did things that did. He said they said he was a great prophet. He could speak with authority. He knew the Bible inside out. He did these amazing miracles. He would heal people. And so they began to put all their hope in him. He was going to be the one. And yet, when he was crucified, when he was killed, it didn't make sense. He didn't fit their expectations of who they thought he was going to be. But more than that, they weren't only confused about who Jesus was, they were confused about the way that God redeems. Because they thought what God was going to do was going to redeem Israel by, again, raising up this military leader who would defeat the Roman armies and liberate Israel. And so they were looking for Judas Maccabeus. You know, they were looking for Joshua or King David or all these stories from the Old Testament. And they thought that's the way God was going to redeem Israel. And yet God knew that's not what they needed redemption from. If they needed redemption from Rome, he would have sent them a military hero. But he sent them a savior instead. And yet, because they were confused about who Jesus was, and they were confused about how God would redeem them, they were also confused about what their place in the story would be. Because in their minds, they thought that once Jesus became king and sort of, you know, liberated them from Rome, that he was going to set up his government and they were all going to be part of it. In fact, they had this argument one time where they said, when Jesus becomes king and sets up his government, who's going to get to sit on his right and be like the vice king? And who's going to get to sit on his left and be like secretary of state? And who's going to be in the cabinet? And who's going to be general? And because we all got in on this thing early. So we're like, that's going to come back to us one of these days. And when it does, we're all going to have like top positions in the government. They literally believe that. And they had put all their hope in that. And they left their homes and followed Jesus, believing that. And suddenly, all that was gone. And it meant their story, their future, their understanding of what their role in this world was gone with it. And they were just confused about it. Now, I think it's important to understand these three things because oftentimes we're in the same place, aren't we? I mean, I got to be honest. I think a lot of times we're confused about who Jesus is. I mean, maybe you're somebody who never has gone to church all your life. And you've heard little snippets about who Jesus is from different things or different people. And it just doesn't add up. It's kind of weird putting it all together. It just sometimes it doesn't make sense. Or maybe you grew up, maybe you did grow up going to church, and what they said about Jesus at the church you were growing up in, like, you didn't buy it. Like, that doesn't, I mean, if that's what God is like, or if that's what Jesus is like, I don't think I believe that. And then we come to the Bible, and sometimes the Bible is confusing, and it's hard to put it all together and understand. So sometimes we're just like these first followers. I think we're also confused about how God redeems. And I think this is true of a lot of Christians, like people that have been Christians for a long time, because I think what redemption looks like in my life is God making sure that I have a pretty easy life, and that I always get the right job, and that I never go through any difficult times where I don't have food or don't have a steady paycheck, that my kids grow up to be really nice and perfect and obedient, and that I never have any major health problems, or if I do, the doctor can take care of them and all. Like, I think we believe that God just wants to make sure everything's nice in our lives all the time. And yet, we go through one of those seasons where everything's not nice, where things are difficult, where things are hard, where you do everything you can and the kids still grow up to be rebels. You know? Or you do everything you can and this health problem won't go away. And when that happens, it totally confuses us because God is not acting the way we thought He was going to act. He's not living up to our expectations and redeeming us in the way that we think He should. And when we get confused about Jesus and when we get confused about God, then certainly we get confused about what our place in the story is, because the story doesn't really make sense anymore. So I'll just kind of do my own thing. I'll go back to fishing. I'll go home. I'll just pay the bills, go to work, get through my life, sort of do things, because I don't know how to fit the God or the Jesus or the faith piece into my life. And yet, in light of all of that, in light of the fact that the disciples had given up on Jesus because they thought He was dead, we don't know if they had given up on God. They were probably good Jews who still believed in God, and yet they had probably given up on God's will for their life. In light of all that, Jesus didn't give up on them. And so He met them on the road, and He began talking with them. And this is what it says next in verse 25. He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter His glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, He explained to them what was said in all the Scriptures concerning Himself." Now, I don't think this is like a rebuke. Like, I don't think He, like, come on, you totally missed it. I think this is almost like Jesus' gentle way of saying, look, let me explain this to you. I know you're confused about me, and that's understandable. It's been a strange weekend. Like, I know you're confused about God, and that's understandable too. And I know you're confused about the way God redeems, and I wish there were simple answers, but there's not, because your problems are not simple. And the world's problems are not simple. So walk with me on this journey. Keep walking with me down this road. Let's open this Bible together and let me begin to explain it to you. And let's open it up and let's not look for like the rules and the do's and the don'ts and the principles and the nuggets. Look at the big picture story. And once you begin to do that, and once you spend some time with me, and once you listen to me, I will help you see that the big picture story is all leading towards me and who I am and what I have done and what I want to do for you. And if you'll do that, and if you'll give me some time, and if you'll stay on the journey, and if you'll keep walking this road with me, eventually you'll begin to understand who I am, who God is, and what your place in the story is. Luke goes on, and it says in the next verse, "As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if He were going farther. But they urged Him strongly, 'Stay with us, for it is nearly evening, and the day is almost over.' So he went in to stay with them. So they've been walking probably the better part of 7 miles, 2, 3, maybe 4 hours talking with Jesus, and maybe getting some answers to their questions. And yet, I think something even bigger is happening here than them just getting answers to their questions. Because they get to the fork in the road where it's, you know, Emmaus is right over there, and Jesus says, I'm going to keep going. And they say, no, like, would you just come and hang out with us a little longer? Like, we just want to be with you. Like, something about these last couple of hours, it's done something inside of us, and we just want to spend more time with you. And the answers you've been giving us have been helpful, and they're starting to show us some things we didn't understand before, but it's even bigger than that. We just want to be with you. And sometimes I think we need to understand that, because we've all got questions, and there's things we still don't, and I still don't understand about God and how He works. And yet, I think God sometimes says, those are good, keep asking those questions, they're important, keep seeking out answers, and yet at the end of the day, sometimes we just need something to happen, not necessarily in our heads, but in our hearts. Sometimes we just need to hang out with Jesus. And when we do that, we'll begin to figure out what this whole thing means. And so, the story concludes. Verse 30, it says this, when he was at the table with them, he took bread and he gave thanks and he broke it and he began to give it to them. And then their eyes were opened and they recognized him and he disappeared from their sight. And they asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem, where they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, it is true, the Lord has risen and he has appeared to Simon. And then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. And we're going to come back next week and read another story of another encounter that Jesus had with some of his disciples. But I love the way this story ends. It's almost like when they cleared away all the clutter and they're sitting there sharing a meal together. Like, they're just eating, like, face to face, put the details, put work, put all the questions, put all that aside. And they're just like, that's the most kind of intimate and relational thing you can do with someone. It's just sitting down and having a meal with them. And when they do that, and then Luke tells us, and when Jesus breaks the bread, which is almost Luke's way of hearkening back to what happened 3 days before, when Jesus broke the bread with his disciples and said, this represents my body that's about to be broken for you. That when he did that, they recognized him and their hearts were changed and they had this experience. And it's almost like it took all of their confusion and it brought it to a place of clarity. It didn't answer all their questions, but it helped them really understand who Jesus was. I want to tell one more story before we wrap up. It's about a man named John Wesley. Anybody heard of John Wesley? Good Methodists in the crowd, maybe. I don't know. But all right. Didn't think we'd get a woo-hoo from that. But so John Wesley was a guy, and if you don't know who he is, you're normal. So if you don't know, John Wesley was this guy, and he lived about 250 years ago. And he actually started what's now the Methodist Church. And and during the time he started it in the 1700s in the U.S., the Methodist Church, and again, at that time it was this more unorganized movement, but it was the most influential, fastest-growing movement in the entire United States. And thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people were hearing about Jesus and about God and were hearing this gospel message for the first time through this movement that this one man started. In fact, he's been called one of the greatest preachers of all time. He would ride around on horseback and he would preach from town to town. And historians have actually taken his journals and they've calculated that he rode 250,000 miles on horseback across the 13 colonies. This is before it was even a country, the 13 colonies, preaching from horseback. Now, what you need to know is that John Wesley grew up in England, and so he's English, and he grew up in a very religious home. So he sort of was a Christian all his life and believed in God all his life. And when he went off to college, he went to Oxford, and he was one of those religious zealots. And he and his brother Charles actually started a club at Oxford called the Holy Club. Talk about like holy roller. You know, like this was the guy everyone hated. He started the Holy Club. Like that's how serious he was about his faith. And then after that, he felt this call to be a missionary. And so he was going to go change the world for God. And so he sailed from England over to what was then the colony of Georgia. And he landed in Georgia and he started his work there. And it was an utter failure. Nobody responded to him. This was before all the other stuff happened. No one responded to him. No one listened to him. He did everything wrong. It was a fiasco. And he ended up getting back on a ship and sailing back to England. And he pretty much lost his faith. He was totally confused about who God was, who Jesus was, this person that he was supposed to be helping other people understand. Like he didn't get it anymore. It was the lowest point in his life. He had no idea what his role was anymore in the story. He wasn't even sure if he was a Christian. He got back to England. And then one night in England, in like the most unassuming, unspectacular way, he had an experience with Jesus. And he wrote about it in his journal. And this is what he says in his journal on May 24th, 1738. In the evening, I went very unwillingly to a church meeting in Aldersgate Street where one was reading Luther's preface to the Epistle to the Romans. Now, let me stop there for a second. First, he went unwillingly to church. So that's kind of funny. Maybe some of you are here unwillingly tonight. But he went unwillingly to church. He wasn't excited about it. And he was like sitting in the back, and a guy stands up and begins reading the preface to this like theological work written by this guy named Martin Luther 200 years before to this theological work on the book of Romans. Like the most dry and boring thing that could ever be a part of a church. So John Wesley is there. He's totally confused. He doesn't believe any of this anymore. He's just, we don't know how he showed up there. He's sitting in the back, and this is what he writes next. About a quarter before nine, while he, that is the man who was reading, was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ. Christ alone for salvation. And an assurance was given me that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death. Wesley later points to that one moment as the first time he really understood who Jesus was, as the first time he really understood who God was, and as a moment that set the trajectory and changed the rest of his life. Now, it didn't answer all his questions. It's interesting, you can read the rest of his journal accounts, and he talks about still having questions, still having doubts. Even later that night, he leaves church and he goes home, and he's like, I'm not sure what happened, and I doubt this and all that. And he's got all these doubts, and yet there was still sort of this defining moment where something happened in his heart. And he met and understood Jesus. And it brought some sort of clarity to his confusion. Now, I don't want to presume anything tonight, like that we're sitting in church and there's John Wesley sitting in here or anything like that. But my hunch is that probably some of us need to experience Jesus like Wesley did. Maybe some of us need to experience him for the first time. Maybe some of us need to experience him like those two disciples on the road to Emmaus who've been following Jesus for a few years but still hadn't figured out how to put it all together. Maybe some of us are like Wesley and we've given a lot of our lives. We've been following Jesus. We call ourselves Christians for a long time and yet or just at one of those points in life where it's like, we don't necessarily need the answers in our head, but we need something to happen in our hearts. And so the question I want to close with is this. Are we willing to open our hearts to let Jesus do something inside of them? This great verse where Jesus says in the Bible, I stand at the door and knock, and anyone who's willing to open the door, I'll come in and sit at the table with that person and dine with them. It's just about a relationship. If you're just open the door, I would love for you to experience who I am. And it's not going to address all your questions, but maybe it'll bring some clarity to what it is you think about me, to what it is you think about God, and to what it is that you understand about your role in this big story. So let me close with a word of prayer, and then we're going to sing a song and be dismissed. Lord God, thanks for this story from the Bible about these two people on the road to Emmaus. It's a good picture of the journey that many of us are on in life. And I pray that you would just give us resilience, that you give us perseverance while we're on that journey through the ups and the downs, and that more than anything else, you would just continue to be present in our lives, and that you would just do something in our hearts to help us really figure out and understand and know you and understand your will for our lives. Thanks for sending your son. Thanks for his death on the cross. Thanks for rising from the grave. Thank you for the grace that you give to each of us. I pray this in your name. Amen.